Though he'd just been given water, Turok had reached the limit of human endurance. He lay back on a cool stone table, but his skin had a dusty cast, as if he had exhausted all the spare moisture that a Fremen carried. "You walked during the day, Turok," Liet said. "Why would you do something so foolish?" "No choice." Turok took another sip of the water that Stilgar offered. A little of it ran down his dusty chin, but he caught it on a forefinger and licked it. Every drop was precious. "My still suit no longer functioned. I knew I was close to Red Wall Siege, but no one would have seen me after dark. I had to hope that you would come to investigate." "You will live to fight Harkonnens again," Stilgar said. "I did not survive merely to fight." Turok spoke with deathly fatigue. His lips were cracked and bleeding, but he refused more water. He described what had happened on the spice harvester, how Harkonnen troops had lifted off the cargo and then abandoned the crew and equipment to the sandworm. "The spice they took will be listed as lost," Leet said, shaking his head. "Shaddam is so wrapped up with silly concerns for protocol and the garments of power that it is easy to trick him. I have seen it with my own eyes. For every stockpile we capture, like the one at Hadith Siege, the Baron creates another." Stilgar looked from Turok to Leet, not liking the implication of what he was thinking. "Should we report this to Count Fenring, or send a message to the Emperor?" "I will have nothing further to do with Kaitain still." Liet didn't even write new reports. He would simply keep sending old documents that his father had written decades before. Shaddam would never notice. "This is a Fremen problem. We do not seek the help of off-worlders." "I was hoping you would say that," Stilgar said, his eyes brightening like those of a carrion bird. Turok accepted more water now. Farula appeared and quietly brought the haggard man a bowl of thick, soothing herbal ointment for his sunburns. After wiping exposed areas with a damp cloth, she began to rub the cream into his skin. Liet looked at his wife fondly, watching her ministrations. Farula was the best healer in the siege. She returned his glance, a confident promise of secrets to be shared later. He had fought hard to win the heart of his beautiful wife. Despite the passion they felt for one another, Fremen tradition forced a man and a woman to keep any expression of it behind the hangings of cave chambers. In public, they led almost separate lives. "The Harkonnens are growing more aggressive, so we must unite in our resistance." Liet's mind returned to business matters. "We Fremen are a great people, scattered on the winds. Summon the Sand Riders to the Speaking Cave. I will dispatch them to other sieges to announce a grand convocation. All Naibs, elders, and fighting men will attend. In the name of my father, Umakynes, this will be a momentous gathering of Fremen." He bent the fingers of one hand like a claw and raised it high. "The Harkonnens have no idea of our combined strength. Like a desert hawk, we will dig our talons into the Baron's backside." Inside the terminal building of the Carthag spaceport, the Baron scowled and paced while preparations continued for his departure to Gedi Prime. He loathed the dry, dusty climate of Arrakis. Pausing to catch his breath, he held on to a railing, his feet barely skimming the floor. Though by no means nimble, his suspensor belt helped the obese man maintain the impression that he was capable of doing anything he wished. Spotlights marked the fused sand landing field. Illumination splashed across fuel storage silos, skeletal cranes, suspensor barges, and blocky hangars constructed from prefab components, all modeled after the architecture of Harko City. He was in a particularly foul mood this evening. His trip home had been delayed for days while he formulated a rebuttal to a notification from the Spacing Guild and Choam, who wanted to audit his spice handling procedures. Again! He had cooperated fully with the usual audit only 5 months ago, and another should not have been due for at least another 19 months. From Gidi Prime, his law techs had filed a detailed letter of inquiry into the matter, which would undoubtedly delay the Guild and Choam, but he had a bad feeling about this. It was all tied in with the Emperor's crackdown on spice stockpiling. Things were changing, and not for the better. As the holder of the Arrakis fief, House Harkonnen was the only Landsrad member legally entitled to any stockpiles at all. But those stocks could only be large enough to fill expected short-term demand from customers placing orders for melange. And each hoard had to be documented in periodic reports to the Emperor. It was all quite involved, and for every shipment that the Baron sent out by Highliner, a tax was owed to House Carino. The customers, for their part, were only permitted to order amounts to fulfill their own short-term needs for food additives, spice fibers, medicinal applications, and the like. For centuries, there had been no means of enforcing the prohibition against ordering too much, which led inevitably to hoarding. And everyone had looked the other way. Until now. Peter! How much longer? The furtive Mentat had been watching crews haul crates and supplies onto the Harkonnen frigate under the yellow-white glow. He'd appeared to be daydreaming, but the Baron knew de Vries was keeping a silent inventory, watching every object loaded aboard, ticking it off against a list inside his brain. "I estimate another standard hour, my Baron. We have much to bring back to Gidi Prime, but these local workers are slow. If you like, I could have one tortured to increase the speed of the others." The Baron considered the suggestion, but shook his head. "We have time before the Highliner arrives. I will wait in the frigate lounge. The sooner I get my feet off this damned planet, the better I'll feel." "Yes, my Baron. Shall I prepare refreshments? It helps for you to rest."
"I don't need rest," the Baron answered, more harshly than he'd intended. He disliked any implication of weakness or inability to perform his duties. The Bene Gesserit had afflicted him with this disgusting, debilitating disease. He'd once been blessed with a perfect body, but that horse-faced Mohiam had turned it into an offensive flesh-dumpling, though it retained the sexual drive and sharp mind he'd had in his youth. The disease itself was a closely held secret. If Shaddam ever decided the Baron was a failing leader, unable to perform the necessary functions on Arrakis, House Harkonnen would be replaced by another noble family. Thus the Baron actively fostered the impression that his corpulence resulted from gluttony and a hedonistic lifestyle, an impression that was not difficult for him to maintain. In fact, he decided with a smile, upon returning to Harkonnen Keep, he would announce an extravagant feast there. To keep up appearances, he would encourage his guests to overindulge as much as he did. The Baron's various physicians had suggested that he spend time in the dry desert climate, asserting that it was better for his health. But he hated Arrakis, despite the wealth he reaped from melange. He returned to Gidi Prime whenever possible, sometimes just to repair the damage his thick-headed nephew, Beast Raban, had done while he was gone. The workers continued their loading, and the guards formed an escort cordon to the ship. Peter de Vries accompanied the Baron across the warm landing field and up the frigate ramp. On board, the Mentat prepared a tiny glass of Sappho juice for himself and brought a decanter of expensive Kirana brandy for his master. The Baron sat in a heavily cushioned couch, rebuilt to accommodate his bulk. and summoned the latest intelligence briefing brought by the frigate captain. He scanned the report with a frown that deepened into an outright scowl. Until now, the Baron had heard nothing about the outrageous Atreides attack upon Baikal and the surprisingly supportive Lansrad reaction. The damnable nobles had actually sympathized with Leto, even applauding his brutal retaliation. And now the Emperor had devastated Zanovar. Things were heating up. "These are unsettled times, my Baron, with many aggressive actions. Remember Grumman and Ekaz." "This Duke Atreides," the Baron raised his briefing packet, clutching it in pasty, ring-studded fingers, "has no respect for law and order. If I were ever to launch Harkonnen forces upon another family, Shaddam would send Sardaukar down my throat. Yet Leto gets away with murder."
"Technically, the Duke violated no laws, my Baron." DeVries paused to make detailed mental projections. "Leto is well-liked among the other houses, and he has their tacit support. Do not underestimate the Atreides' popularity, which seems to grow every year. Many of the houses look up to the Duke. They see him as a hero." The Baron gulped his brandy and gave a disbelieving snort. "For some unknown reason." With a grunt, he leaned back on the couch, pleased to hear the rumble of engines starting at last. The frigate rose from the glassy ground and into the blackness of night.
"Think, my Baron." DeVries rarely risked such a tone with him. "The death of Leto's son may have been a short-term victory for us, but now it is becoming a victory for House Atreides as well. The tragedy has generated much sympathy for the Duke. The Lansrad members will grant him leniency, and he can get away with actions no one else would dare. Baikal is a case in point."
Irked by the success of his nemesis, the Baron blew air through his puffy lips. Outside the windows of the frigate, at the edge of orbit, he watched the atmosphere fade into starlit indigo. Exasperated, he turned back to DeVries. "But why do they like Leto so much, Peter? Why him, and not me? What exactly has an Atreides ever done for them?"
The Mentat furrowed his brow.
"Popularity can be an important coin, if spent properly. Leto Atreides actively tries to woo the Lansrad. You, my Baron, choose to hammer your rivals into submission. You use acid instead of honey, not courting them as you could."
"It has always been difficult for me." He narrowed his spider-black eyes and swelled his chest with fresh determination. "But if Leto Atreides can do it, then by all the demons in the cosmos, I can do it as well."
DeVries smiled. "Allow me to suggest that you consult an advisor, my Baron. Perhaps even hire an etiquette instructor to reshape your actions and moods."
"I don't need a man to tell me how to hold my fork in a dainty fashion."
DeVries cut him off before his annoyance could grow. "There are many skills, my Baron. Etiquette, like politics, is a complex weaving of fine threads. It is difficult for an untrained person to keep track of them all. You are the leader of a great house, therefore you must perform better than any commoner."
Baron Harkonnen remained silent as the frigate pilot guided them toward the giant guild ship above. He finished his potent, smoky brandy. He didn't like to admit it, but knew his mentat had spoken truly.
"And where would we find such an etiquette advisor?"
"I suggest obtaining one from Chusuk, which is well known for its courtliness and manners. They make balisets, write sonnets, and are considered highly refined and cultured."
"Very well."
A glint of humor flickered across the Baron's face. "And I'll want Rabban to go through the same instruction."
DeVries kept himself from smiling.
"I am afraid your nephew may be beyond redemption."
"Probably.
I want him to try, anyway.
It shall be arranged, my baron, the moment we reach Gedi Prime.
The Mentat took a sip of his Sappho juice, while his master poured another snifter of Kirana brandy and quaffed it.
Mentats accumulate questions the way others accumulate answers. Mentat teaching.
When word came that Gurney and Thufir had at last returned from Ix and were taking a shuttle down from the Highliner in orbit, Romber insisted on meeting them at the spaceport in person. He was both anxious and uneasy to hear what they had found on his once beautiful planet.
"Be prepared for whatever news they bring, Prince," Duncan Idaho said.
Immaculate in his green and black Atreides uniform, the young swordmaster wore a determined expression on his round face.
"They will tell us the truth."
Romber's expression did not flicker, but he turned his eyes toward Duncan.
"I have not heard a detailed report from Ix in years, and I am eager for any news at all. It could not be worse than what I've already imagined."
The prince walked with exaggerated care, but he kept his balance and accepted no assistance. Rather than choosing more traditional honeymoon activities, his new wife Tessia had worked with him unceasingly, helping Romber become proficient in his cyborg body. Like an overprotective father, Dr. Yue worried about his patient, testing functions and nerve impulse transmissions, until Romber finally ordered the Sook doctor out of his private apartments. Now, moving with determination and buoyed by Tesha's faith in him, Romber took no discouragement from the curious or pitying stares. He combated their instinctive avoidance of his freakish appearance with grins in response. His good-natured personality shamed others into accepting him. Outside the Kala Municipal Spaceport, under skies thick with clouds, the two watched the fingernail scratch of the descending shuttle's ionization trail. As a light rain began to fall, Romber and Duncan drew deep breaths of the salty air, pleased to feel the dampness on their skin and hair. The Guild shuttle aligned itself with a marked landing grid and settled into Caladan's embrace. People pushed forward to greet emerging passengers. Dressed in the faded cloaks of down-on-their-luck merchants, Gurney Halleck and Thufir Hawat followed a line of disembarking visitors. They looked like a million others in the Imperium, but these two had defied all odds, infiltrating Ix right under the noses of the Tleilaxu. Recognizing them, Romber rushed forward. His hurried movements became jerky instead of smooth, but he did not care.
"Do you have information, Gurney?"
Romber spoke in the coded Atreides battle language.
"Thufir, what did you find?"
Gurney, who had experienced so much horror in the Harkonnen slave pits, looked deeply disturbed. Thufir walked on legs as stiff and leaden as Romber's own. The weathered Mentat took a deep breath to marshal his thoughts, choosing his words carefully.
"My lord prince, we have witnessed much. Oh, what these eyes have seen. And as a Mentat, I can never forget."
Leto Atreides called a private war council in one of the tower chambers. These apartments had been used by his mother, Lady Helena, as a personal sitting room before she'd been exiled to the eastern continent. But the chambers had remained unused for some time. Until now. Servants dusted the corners and window sills and built a roaring fire in the river rock fireplace. Romber had little physical need to rest and relax, and stood waiting like a prominent piece of furniture. Initially, Leto sat in one of his mother's embroidered cushioned chairs, where she used to curl up and read daily devotions from the Orange Catholic Bible. But he thrust the chair away, selecting instead a taller wooden one. These were not comfortable times. Thufir Hawat presented his detailed summary of what they had seen,
and done. As the Mentat dictated the brutal facts, his companion frequently interjected emotional comments, hammering home his revulsion and disgust.
"Sadly, my Duke," Awat said, "we have overestimated the capabilities and accomplishments of Keter Pilru and his supposed freedom fighters. We found little organized resistance. The Ixian people are broken. Sardaukar forces, 2 legions of them, and Tleilaxu spies are everywhere."
Gurney added, "They sent face dancers to mimic Ixians and slip into rebel cells. The resistance fighters have been massacred several times."
"We did observe widespread discontent, but no organization," Hawat continued.
"However, given the proper catalyst, I project that the Ixian population will rise up and overthrow the Tleilaxu."
"Then we must provide that catalyst."
Romber took a heavy step forward.
"Me."
Duncan shifted in one of the chairs, unwilling to relax. "I see tactical difficulties. The invaders have become entrenched. They won't be expecting a surprise attack after all this time, of course, but even with full Atreides military forces, it would be suicide, especially against Sardaukar."
Gurney noted, "Why does Shaddam have Imperial soldiers inside Ix? As far as I know, it's not authorized by the Landsraad."
Leto was not convinced.
"The Emperor makes his own rules. Remember Zanovar."
His dark eyebrows drew together.
"We have the moral high ground, Leto," Romber insisted, "just like we did on Baikal."
After having waited so long for revenge, the prince was now filled with fire. Partly through Tesha's efforts, but more of his own volition, a new core inside him had come alive. Romber paced the room with precise steps, mechanical legs humming, as if his mind was so restless that it had to burn off excess energy.
"I was destined to become the Earl of House Vernius, like my father before me."
He raised an arm, fist clenched, then lowered it. The servo motors and pulley musculature dramatically increased his strength. Romber had already demonstrated that he could crush rocks in the palm of his hand. He turned his scarred face toward the Duke, who still sat brooding in the hard chair.
"Leto, I've watched how your people view you with love, respect, and loyalty. Now Tesha has helped me realize that for all these years I was trying to regain Ix for the wrong reasons. My heart wasn't in it, because I did not see how much it mattered. I was indignant at losing what was mine. I was angry at the Tleilaxu for crimes against me and my family. But what about the Ixian people, even the poor duped suboids who followed promises of a better life?"
"Aye, those promises led them right over a cliff," Gurney said. "When the shepherd is a wolf, the flock becomes only so much meat." Though Romber stood close to the orange flames in the fireplace, he couldn't feel the heat. "I want to regain my world, not for myself, but because it's what the people of Ix need. If I am to be Earl Vernius, then I serve them, not the other way around." Hawat's memory-haunted face softened into a smile.
"You have learned an important lesson, Prince."
"Yes, but putting it into practice will require considerable work," Duncan said. "Unless we have some hidden advantage or secret weapon, our military forces will be in great danger. Remember what we'll be up against." Leto considered Romber's plight and acknowledged that the Vernius line would die with him, no matter what he achieved on Ix. And he felt a warm glow inside to think of Jessica's pregnancy. He himself would have another child, a son, he hoped, though she would not say. He felt a pang, knowing she would soon depart for Kaitain. The Duke had never imagined how his life would play out, how he would grow to care for Jessica after he'd first resented her presence so much. The Bene Gesserits had coerced him into keeping her here at Castle Caladan. angered by their obvious manipulations, he had vowed never to take her as a lover. But he'd eventually played right into the sisterhood's plans. They had bribed him with information about her Conan schemes, a new kind of battleship. Leto sat up with a start, and a slow smile spread across his lean face.
Wait!
They all fell silent as he organized his thoughts. The only sound in the room was the crackle of the fire. Thufir, you were present when the Bene Gesserit witches made a bargain with me to keep Jessica here. Puzzled, Hawat tried to follow the Duke's train of thought. Then the Mentat's eyebrows raised. They traded you information. There was an unseen ship, a vessel sporting new technology that rendered it optically invisible, even to scanners. Leto pounded his fist on the table and leaned forward. The prototype of that Harkonnen ship crashed on Wallach 9. The sisters have the vessel in their possession. Wouldn't it be helpful if we could convince them to give us that technology? Duncan lurched to his feet. With undetectable ships, we could infiltrate an entire force into Ix before the Sardaukar could rally to the Tlaloxu defense. His face a mask of determination, Leto rose slowly and said, "They owe me, by the hells. Thufir, send a message to the Mother School asking for Bene Gesserit cooperation. More than any other house, we have the right to that information, since the technology was used against us." He looked over at Romber, a predatory smile cracking his stern countenance. "And then, my friend, we shall spare no effort to regain Ix." The less we know, the longer the explanation. Bene Gesserit Ajar Book. Renegade copy. With a collective memory that stretched into the murky shadows of history, the ancient Mother Superior Harishka had no need for advice from her sisters. Yet recollections from the deep past were not always applicable to the future, or to the current tapestry of imperial politics. Harishka stood inside a stucco-walled private meeting chamber. Her most trusted advisers, well-trained in subtleties and consequences, moved around the room, their robes rustling like the wings of ravens. Duke Leto's unexpected request had spurred them into a sudden and unwelcome meeting. Acolytes brought in a selection of juices, tea, and spice coffee. The sisters pondered, sipping beverages, but the room remained strangely silent, devoid of casual conversation. Such matters required serious contemplation. Harishka glided to a rough stone bench and sat down. Cold and hard, it was not the sort of throne a powerful leader could have asked for. But the Bene Gesserit knew how to cope with discomfort. Her mind was sharp, her memories vivid. That was all a Mother Superior required. The appointed sisters settled down with a rustle of skirts. As gray-muffled sunshine filtered through the prismatic skylights, their crystal-shard eyes turned toward Harishka. It was time for the Mother Superior to speak. "We have allowed ourselves to ignore this matter for years, and now we are forced to make a choice." She mentioned the message cylinder that had recently arrived from Caladan. "We should not have told Leto Atreides of the no-ship's existence in the first place," said Dur, Reverend Mother Lanali, who managed the Mother School's map room and geographical archives. "It was necessary," Harishka said. "He would not have accepted Jessica unless we threw him a significant bone. To his credit, the Duke has not abused the information." "He is doing it now," said Reverend Mother Thora, who tended the orchards and was an expert in cryptography. Early in her career, she had developed a technique for implanting messages on the leaves of plants. Arishka disagreed. The Duke could have used the information in many ways, yet instead he chose to go through private channels maintaining our secret. Thus far, he has not betrayed our confidence. And I might remind you that Jessica now carries his child, as we had hoped.
But what took her so long to get pregnant? Asked another woman. It should have been done much sooner.
Arishka did not meet her gaze. It makes no difference. Let us attend to the matter at hand.
I concur, said Reverend Mother Sienna, whose heart-shaped face still bore the aura of innocent beauty that had deceived so many men in her younger years. If anyone should be granted the power to make unseen warships, it is Duke Atreides. Like his father and grandfather before him, he is a man of impeccable credentials, a man of honor.
Lanali made a disbelieving sound.
Have you forgotten what he did on Baikal, wiping out the entire war memorial?
His war memorial, Sienna countered. And he was provoked.
Even if Duke Leto is trustworthy, what about future Atreides dukes? Lanali said.
Her words measured.
That opens up a significant unknown factor, and unknowns are dangerous.
But there are significant known factors as well, Sienna said.
You worry too much. The youngest member of the group, slender sister Christine, interrupted.
This decision has nothing to do with Atreides' moral character. Such a weapon, even if used for passive defense, would change the texture of warfare in the Imperium. Invisibility technology offers a huge tactical advantage to any house that possesses it. Whether you have a softness for him or not, Sienna, Leto Atreides is no more than a pawn in our master plan, as was Baron Harkonnen.
The Harkonnens developed the terrible weapon in the first place, said Thora, finishing her spice coffee and standing to refill her cup. Thankfully, they lost the secret and have not been able to retrieve it.
Lately, Arishka had begun to note the increasing amount of melange the orchard keeper consumed. Bene Gesserits could control their body chemistry, but they were strongly discouraged from extending their lifetimes beyond certain levels. Flaunting their longevity could move popular opinion against the sisterhood. Arishka decided to conclude this phase of the discussion. She had heard enough.
We have no choice in the matter. We must reject Leto's demand. We will send our response with Reverend Mother Mohiam when she goes to escort Jessica to Kaitain.
She lifted her head. Her brain was so full of memories and free thoughts, it weighed heavily on her shoulders. Thara let out a sigh, recalling how much work the acolytes had done to dissect and analyze the damaged ship.
I don't know how much we could tell Duke Leto anyway. We could give him the vessel wreckage, but even we do not understand how the field generator works.
She looked around the room, gulped more spice coffee. Dark-haired Sister Christine spoke up again.
Such a weapon could be catastrophic if unleashed in the Imperium. But how much more terrible if even we do not understand how it functions? We must learn all we can and keep the secret safely with the Sisterhood.
She had been trained as a commando to slip in and perform aggressive actions when subtler schemes failed to achieve their desired ends. Because of her youth, Christine did not have the patience of a reverend mother, though at times Arishka considered such impetuousness useful.
Absolutely correct.
The Mother Superior shifted on the hard stone bench.
Certain markings on the wreckage indicate that someone named Chobin was involved.
We have since learned that an inventor by that name defected from Richies to Gedi Prime around the time this invisibility system was developed.
Thara finished her third cup of spice coffee, ignoring Harishka's disapproving frown.
The Harkonnens must have disposed of the man too soon, or they would not have had such difficulty reproducing the invisibility generator for themselves. Arishka folded her spidery hands in her lap. Naturally, we will begin our inquiries on Richie's. Superstition and desert necessities permeate the Fremen life, in which religion and law are intertwined. The Ways of Arrakis, an imperial film book for children. On a day that would establish the future of his people, Liet Kynes awoke thinking of the past. He sat at the edge of the bed he shared with Farula, a padded mat upon the rock floor of a small but comfortable room in Redwall Siege. The great Fremen convocation would begin today, a meeting of all Siege leaders to determine a unified response against the Harkonnens. Too often the desert people had remained scattered, independent, and ineffective. They allowed clan rivalries, feuds, and distractions to come between them. Liet would have to make them understand. His father would have been able to accomplish such a change with no more than an offhand comment. Pardet Kynes, the ecological prophet, had never understood his own power, but simply accepted it as a means to accomplish his goal of creating an Eden on Dune. His son Liet, though, was young and unproven. Sitting on the sleeping pallet, Liet heard the low, almost imperceptible hum of machinery recirculating air in the siege. Beside him, Farula breathed softly, obviously awake but silent and contemplative. She liked to look at her husband with her deep blue eyes. "My troubles have kept you from resting, my love," he said to her. Farula rubbed his shoulders. "Your thoughts are my thoughts, dearest. My heart feels your concern and your passion." He kissed her hand. She rubbed her knuckles across the thin, sandy beard he had grown. "Do not worry. The blood of Oma Kynes flows within you, as does his dream." "But will the Fremen see it?" "Our people may be foolish at times, but not blind." Liet Kynes had loved her for years. Farula was a Fremen woman, the daughter of old Hynar, the Siege's one-eyed Naib. She knew her role. She was the best healer in the tribe, and her greatest work had been to heal Liet's grief-stricken soul. She knew how to touch her husband and love him. Still worried about the challenge of the convocation, he drew her to him and held her close on the warm sleeping pallet. But she kissed his uncertainty away, stroked his anxiety until it was gone, and imparted strength to him. "I will be with you, my love," Farula said, although women would not be allowed into the speaking chamber, where the naibs of the scattered sieges gathered to hear his words. Once they left their quarters, Liet and his wife would become formal again, cultural strangers. But he understood what Farula meant. She would indeed be with him. His heart felt glad with the knowledge. Across the doorway hung a colorful spice fiber tapestry, into which the women of the Siege had woven an inspiring depiction of Plaster Basin, where his father had established a bountiful greenhouse demonstration project. The tapestry showed running water, hummingbirds, fruit trees, and bright flowers. Closing his eyes, Liet imagined the ambrosia of the plants and pollens, felt damp air on his cheeks. "I hope today I will do something to make you proud, Father," he murmured to himself, as if in prayer. Tragically, a moisture-laden ceiling had collapsed on Pardet and several of his assistants. Less than a year had passed since that terrible day, but to Liet it seemed much longer. He had to fill the shoes of the great visionary. The old must always make way for the new. Hynar, the aging Naib, might soon relinquish his leadership of Redwall Siege,
and many Fremen assumed Liet would take his place as Naib. The Fremen word had an ancient Chakobsa meaning, servant of the siege. Liet harbored no personal ambitions of any sort. He simply wanted to serve his people, fight against Harkonnens, and continue guiding the wasteland toward an eventual garden on Dune. Liet was only half Fremen, but from the first breaths he had taken, the first moments his heart had beaten free of his mother's womb, his soul had been Fremen. As the new imperial planetologist, successor to the great dreamer Pardut Kynes, Liet could not confine his work to a single tribe. Before the last leaders arrived and the great convocation began, Liet needed to complete his daily duties as planetologist. On the fourth, as a man or an emperor, Liet's scientific work remained a valuable part of his existence. Each moment of life was as precious as water itself, and he would not waste it. He dressed quickly, wide awake now. By the time dawn broke in a splash of orange across the landscape, he was outside wearing his new stillsuit. Even at such an early hour, the sand and rocks were warm, and heat devils danced over the terrain. He trudged along a rocky ridge only a few hundred meters from the siege entrance. In a hollow, he inspected a small biological testing station, an array of sensors and data collection devices built into the rock. Pardut Kynes had renovated the forgotten equipment years ago, and Liet's siege members continued to maintain the raised panel of meters and control switches. The instruments measured wind velocities, temperatures, and aridity. One sensor showed an infinitesimal air moisture reading, a trace of dew picked up by the egg-shaped collector. Hearing a loud squeak and a frantic fluttering of wings, he turned quickly. A small desert mouse, called a muad'Dib in the language of the Fremen, had been trapped by a hawk in the shiny metal plas bowl of the solar scanner. The little mouse tried to scramble up the slick sides of the bowl, only to be swatted back down by the swipe of a powerful talon as the hawk tried to secure its prey. The muad'Dib appeared to be doomed. Liet did not interfere. Nature must take its course. To his surprise, he saw the collector begin to move as the mouse tripped a small release catch in the bowl. Its scurryings changed the angle so that reflected rays of the rising sun flashed directly into the hawk's eyes. Blinded, the bird missed with another swipe of its claw, and the desert mouse escaped into a tiny crack in the rocks. Liet watched with amazed amusement and muttered the ancient words of a Fremen hymn that Ferula had taught him. I drove my feet through a desert whose mirage fluttered like a ghost. Voracious for glory, greedy for danger, I roamed the horizons of Al-Kulab, watching time level the mountains in its search and its hunger for me. And I saw the sparrows swiftly approach, bolder than the onrushing wolf. They spread in the tree of my youth. I heard the flock in my branches, and was caught on their beaks and claws. What was it his friend Warwick had said in agony after consuming the water of life?